Millions of Americans suffer from opioid addiction. The ongoing epidemic claims tens of thousands of lives every year, overdoses largely attributed to prescription pills and heroin. And although the sheer numbers of today are more than at any other time on record, the opioid crisis is far from new. So for a look back at that history, let's go to Nathan Connolly and Joanne Freeman. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Nathan, Joanne, welcome back.
Hey, Jeremy.
Thanks for having us.
So this story of addiction goes by many names throughout U.S. history. Take us to the early days of the country when the use of opium, the dried condensed juice of the poppy plant, started to become more common. What was going on?
So looking back to early America, opium was seen for a long time as a kind of wonder drug. Because, you know, in that time period when medicine was relatively primitive, and there were certainly any number of ways in which people were not only sick but had pain, serious pain. And opium was magical because it was a pain killer. And so doctors pretty much prescribed it for anything and everything, for aches and pains and stomach trouble and fevers and anything else. They would either give opium or some sort of tincture with opium and something else. But opium was very widely prescribed. They weren't thinking about opium, although they noticed that it tended to be, or it seemed to be for some people, habit forming. The idea of addiction or that someone was an addict was not in the thinking of that period. And at that point, it really was a personal issue. They linked it with alcohol and alcohol. They also didn't say alcoholism, but alcohol and opium were both things that people seemed to have a compulsion towards or a habit about. And so there were people trying to help people break that kind of habit, but it was very much on a personal scale.
And the most common users in the early days were Continental and British soldiers treated on the battlefield. But what about when we get to the Civil War? How did things change?
Mm-hmm. Well, right. So the Civil War period obviously is a period of enormous pain of all kinds, and particularly morphine, which comes about really in the early 19th century. That becomes a real drug of choice during the Civil War and after the Civil War, and is widely, widely used. And obviously, although it's seen as an alternative to opium, maybe a better alternative to opium, it's as much, if not more, addictive and becomes an enormous problem.
And I noticed that white women made up a large number of users after the Civil War. What was driving that?
Well, you have to understand that the medical profession was largely still segregated at this period. So if you go to the South or even parts, you know, North, you find a number of physicians who were only making these kinds of painkillers available to whites and particularly to white women. You have a number of corners of the South where some two-thirds of those who we would call addicts today are white women. And a large part of what's driving that, of course, are difficulties with childbirth, right? All kinds of uterine complications that really do require pretty acute pain medication. The other thing that was kind of connected to this, of course, was the use of opiums in places like Chinatown in San Francisco or Chinatown in New York. And there was a very real concern among a number of critics and observers that white women would also be descending into these opium dens and possibly fall prey to any manner of kind of oriental predation, to use that language, that might come from that period. So the problem of white women and the use of this particular drug was certainly sharp in the late 19th century.
They're blaming the Chinese immigrants for the problem. A lot of people, you're saying, just the way that these days we hear even President Trump blaming Mexicans for the drug problems.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of local and state laws that were unfurled in the 1870s and 1880s, particularly, again, like San Francisco had a very sharp ordinance curtailing opium use in Chinatown. The state of California eventually adopted a statewide policy. But by the time you got to the 19-teens, you know, about 1915 or so, you had a number of states that effectively tried to target these kinds of underground uses. And it's largely a state and local issue. The actual name of the Opium Exclusion Act, 1909, is eerily reminiscent of the Chinese Exclusion Act, right?
Wow. And the
idea was to, if you can control the influx of Chinese or control the influx of opium, you can basically make sure that these kinds of difficulties effectively don't cross the color line. But Jeremy, there's an important kind of thread running through all of this, which is that as regulation changes, and the drug's form changes, the meaning of use and abuse also changes, as does the nature of government response. So the Opium Act of 1909 actually creates a huge spike in the price of opium, particularly opium smoking. So it requires other kinds of underground versions to basically take its place, changing the way, of course, then the drug is then enforced.
Now, we've been talking about opium. In 1898, we had the invention of heroin right before World War I. What happened there?
So the use of heroin was first popularized by Bayer, which added it to its pills in 1898. A German engineer found a way to basically pull this one strain out of opium, diacetylmorphine, as a strain which ultimately becomes heroin. And that becomes part of what then is the street drug used in place of opium. And what's remarkable about the kind of creation of this cheaper form is it then creates all kinds of mischief in the ways in which bureaucrats talk about it. So in the 1930s, you obviously have prohibition that ends in 1933, but there's still a ramping up of the policing of heroin. And so it's thought that if you can find a way to expand what the dangers of heroin might be by including, say, marijuana as a gateway drug, then you can have a much larger kind of enforcement. And there's one particular official, Harry Anslinger, who basically runs the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, who's very adamant about not only talking about the dangers of marijuana and opium, but then also racializing the drug. So the first time you really do begin to see labels about the breakdown of the black family or the targeting of kind of wayward whites at a federal level begins really in the 1930s and the dangers of heroin as a kind of drug of last resort for those who might begin with marijuana or other lesser drugs.
But let me point out a broader pattern here that based on what Nathan was just saying and links back to what I was just saying, and that is the overall pattern really is that someone comes up with what appears to be some new wonder drug or wonder something that begins to be prescribed by doctors
right. More
and more widely, possibly even overprescribed, becomes widespread, moves beyond that realm. Then, of course, it does bring in all of these questions, not just about what to do for the people who are addicted, but then what do you do? How do you enforce? How do you pinpoint? What's the line? I mean, the other interesting thing about opioids generally, and I think just drugs generally, is that I think certainly many people have a sense that there's a strong dividing line between, on the one hand, medical drugs and then on the other hand, you know,
right. Drugs,
you know, that they're right. Bad things and good things. And the fact of the matter is that the opioid story shows you the very blurry middle ground between the two and that you can't really draw that line. It's a matter of things shifting over time.
Is the history of drug use and addiction in the United States dramatically different than it is in other countries? I mean, we know now that doctors in this country prescribe far more opioids than doctors in other countries.
Right. So, you know, there was an effort in Portugal, for instance, to kind of legalize, narcotics effectively. And they saw some pretty remarkable consequences. This is in the early 2000s, where you saw reductions in HIV/AIDS transmission. You saw reductions, obviously, in incarceration. But one of the things about the Portugal case that doesn't necessarily hold in the U.S. case, particularly around the legalization debates, is that since the 1970s, there's been a pretty consistent expansion of other kinds of social services that could take the place of, say, law enforcement in a variety of different corners, right? So in this country, as much as there are debates about legalization in certain states like Colorado or Alaska, or even about taking, you know, the question of oxycodone and its abuse and making it more of a medical issue and not criminalizing, you know, opioids in the way that they once were, the difficulty, of course, is that what kinds of other supports are in place. It's no secret that the underground economy of the drug trade basically took the place of certain kinds of gainful employment in communities that suffered under deindustrialization, right? Or the difficulty of keeping drugs out of school has a lot to do with other forms of segregation, white flight, and so forth. So any debate that happens in this country around drug policy needs to also be a conversation about other kinds of social services and the role of the state more generally, not just in terms of enforcing drug policy, but providing other kinds of services to communities that might be going through other kinds of pain.
And I think in many ways, although there's a different combination of factors making it a problem in earlier America still, as you just pointed out, it's a whole bundle of things and it's easy to look at one section of that problem and not see all the problems. I also have to add, Nathan, you pulled Portugal out of there. I'm very impressed.
That is the first Portugal reference on the show this week. So
Beautiful. You
win a prize. Nathan Connolly and Joanne Freeman, they are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.